This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Healthcare mergers and acquisitions often mean job cuts. What about Carle Hospital buying Bromen in Normal?
No, quite the opposite. Actually, we believe there's the opportunity to be able to expand services, and so the likelihood is that we will be able to grow.
Hear more from Bromen CEO Colleen Kennedy on Advocate's sale of Bromen to Carle. Plus, the new McLean County Health Department director lays out her priorities as funding shrinks. U.S. Representative Sherry Bustos talks about empowering Medicare to get better drug prices from pharmaceutical companies. And John Norton dives into the legacy of Chicago blues in both preserving tradition and leading innovation. All that and a GLT News update on the way. This is Sound Ideas on GLT.
Support for the Sound Ideas podcast comes from GLT listeners. Join the community of news consumers who listen to Sound Ideas and are also willing to support it financially. Learn more about listener-supported radio and GLT at WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Carle Foundation Hospital in Urbana is buying Advocate Bromen in Normal and Advocate Eureka Medical Center in Woodford County from Chicago-based Advocate Aurora Healthcare. Carle has more than 20 service locations throughout East Central Illinois, stretching from near Effingham in the south north to Watseka. This would extend Carle's territory slightly west. Advocate has said the sale, pending regulatory approval, will free them to concentrate on other areas in its service area in northern Illinois and Wisconsin. We reached Advocate Bromen CEO Colleen Kennedy to find out why she thinks this is a good deal for Bloomington Normal.
Bromen and Eureka have a longstanding partnership and have been doing a lot of clinical partnership with Carle over the last couple of years, including areas like gynecology and some advanced cancer, trauma services, infectious disease. And so we really view this as the next evolution in our partnership with them, and quite frankly, the opportunity from a regional perspective to join a large, strong, patient-centered healthcare system, we believe will allow us to continue to grow in our community and to expand services not only here locally but throughout the region.
You were already part of a large, strong system. What makes this better?
Right. No, I think, you know, from a regional perspective, over the last 10 years, our partnership with Advocate, now Advocate Aurora, has been fantastic, and we are stronger today because of the partnership of Advocate and the support and what they have provided to this region and the investments that they've made. And as we've continued to strengthen our partnership with Carle and the work that we're doing, Advocate is also continuing now. When we joined, it was Advocate. Now it's Advocate Aurora. And as Advocate looks at other markets and the markets where they serve, we just believe that now was the right time for us to join and to become a part of a large, regional, strong healthcare system, and that it made sense, the best opportunity for our patients and for the communities.
Advocate and Aurora joined in 2018. Is that pretty much digested now, or is that still in process?
So no, I think Advocate and Aurora have come together and have really worked on a lot of the centralization of what it takes to operate as one system, and I think that integration is pretty much done. And for us, again, going back to our focus has been on the partnership that we've been doing and the relationships that we've built with Carle from a local perspective, and so the timing just made sense for us to join Carle and to really be a part of a strong regional system. And the opportunity to continue to expand. And I think the other thing I would say to you, Charlie, is you know, Carle as an integrated healthcare system has a health plan, and so, you know, our opportunity and our focus and our ability to do some unique things for this market and this region will be really fantastic going forward.
How does that work? You're talking about Health Alliance, right?
Health Alliance, right. Health Alliance is the only provider, what Carl has is the only provider-based health plan in the state, which is just a unique opportunity in terms of the delivery of care and clinically really being able to focus on how to provide care to patients in the best setting.
Does that really change things for insured people in Bloomington Normal? Health Alliance already has a sizable presence in the community because it's an option for state workers. Does that make it easier for you, or is it relatively neutral?
I think it's a wonderful opportunity for us because we will be a part of Carl and have a health plan. And so, you know, we've not begun to explore what opportunities that might present, but we believe it will be really great going forward and present a wonderful opportunity for our patients in the community.
What does this mean for employment at Broman and its associated businesses?
So Carl is very committed to all of our two, we call them team members. Carl's very committed to all of our team members, and we anticipate that all of our team members will want to move over and become a part of the Carl system.
So are there duplications that will be looked at to trim things down?
No, quite the opposite. Actually, we believe there's the opportunity as we would look to the future to be able to expand services, and so the likelihood is that we will be able to grow, which will be great for not only our community from a patient care perspective, but also from an economic development perspective.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker with Advocate Broman CEO Colleen Kennedy talking about the Carl acquisition of Broman and Eureka Medical Centers from Chicago-based Advocate. The Advocate system is much larger than the Carl system. How will that affect access to capital and the ability to replace or acquire expensive equipment and new technology?
So Carl is an incredibly strong system from a financial perspective, and I think, you know, their focus, Charlie, is really on the region, and so I think from an access to capital perspective, obviously it's too early to say how that plays out, but given the focus geographically with Carl, the opportunity to continue to make significant investments and look at new services and upgrading capital will be very good.
Can you give listeners a sense of that health? I mean, I've heard it said that Carl is financially wealthier than a lot of systems its size, but what does that mean?
I don't have those numbers to be able to provide.
Advocate Broman and Eureka have been the southernmost piece of Advocate.
Correct.
Did that present Advocate an easy option to offload when it wanted to concentrate on Aurora and points north?
I don't think this is a situation of offloading. It's been a natural evolution of the partnerships that we've developed here locally with Carl, with their physicians, and the clinical service alignment. And as Advocate, Aurora continues to look at growing, the alignment and the timing of this really just presented a great win for us and for our community and for the region.
How important is regionality in healthcare?
I believe regionality is very important, and the opportunity to have strong clinical partners that can help to expand the services that are provided locally, and even sometimes sharing of physicians across different markets, and then the opportunity to have a strong tertiary quaternary partner within the region to be able to transfer a higher level of trauma, like a level one trauma. I think it's a great benefit to our community to have that within the region.
There are about 100 healthcare mergers every year. That trend has been fairly constant the last decade or more. With the acquisition of Broman and Eureka by Carl, does this create a likelihood of further regional consolidation with other systems such as Unity Point and Peoria or Springfield Memorial?
I would not be able to begin to speculate on what Carl's plans might be from that perspective.
What are your plans?
But me personally, I am very excited about this opportunity. I am remaining on as president of Broman and Eureka and will lead this part of the market, and then very much looking forward to becoming a part of the Carl leadership team.
How would you assess the cultural differences between the two organizations?
From the work that we've done together over the last 2 years, I would say culturally both organizations are incredibly aligned around patient safety, quality, service, and I believe this will absolutely be a seamless transition.
There was a study in the New England Journal of Medicine recently that questions the impact of healthcare mergers on patient outcomes. Financial stability improves for healthcare institutions. They improve technology, but not necessarily prices. Those tend to go up because larger hospitals then have better bargaining power with insurers. And it seems to be relatively neutral or in some cases negative for patient outcomes. What's your sense of that sitting on the other side of the table?
So my sense is, given our integration with Advocate over the last 10 years, we've improved our quality outcomes. We've improved our safety. We've made care expanded and added new services, and we have made care more affordable. And that's been a part of our commitment, and that will absolutely continue as a part of the Carle Health System.
When do you think the merger trend will ease up?
I cannot begin to speculate on the merger trends and what that will look like going forward. I just know in change, healthcare is a constant, and the landscape is ever evolving, and we are continuing to evolve with that.
Colleen Canaday is the CEO of Advocate Broman and Eureka Medical Centers. She talked with us about the acquisition of Advocate Broman and Eureka by Carle Hospital in Champaign-Urbana. I'm Charlie Schlenker. This is 89.1 and WGLT.org.
Support for GLT comes from Fox & Hounds Hair Salon and Day Spa, helping you create your most beautiful look with salon services for hair and nails, facial, deep tissue, stone and relaxation massage, and waxing and sugaring. A full list of services at fox-n-hounds.com. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Still to come, Dusty Rhodes' final series piece, Far From Home, about housing special needs children in Illinois outside of the state. Legal marijuana, teen vaping, and rural HIV are just a few of the key issues McLean County's new health department administrator faces. Jessica McKnight is taking over a department facing staff and funding cuts as more money goes to mental health. McKnight currently directs the St. Francis County Health Center in Farmington, Missouri, south of St. Louis. She replaces Camille Rodriguez, who became the McLean County administrator. McKnight tells WGLT's Eric Stock she wants to address the larger needs the county's recent health assessment identified: mental health, obesity, unhealthy living, and providing health care in underserved areas.
Increasing access to those services, so focusing on those rural communities in McLean County, getting in there and seeing what's happening, hear from the people there, what their needs are, and ways that we may, as the health department and those partnerships, be able to meet the needs.
One of the concerns in rural areas that we are seeing based on a national report is HIV cases. While they are down nationally, primarily in major cities, they are growing in rural areas, with lack of access to health care being a primary concern. Many smaller communities are also dealing with the effects of an opioid epidemic. And coming from a mostly rural area just south of St. Louis, have you seen ways to expand healthcare access in rural areas to address these concerns?
Yes. And so, you know, a focus on education, on prevention and harm reduction measures. So, you know, Narcan to prevent overdoses, also preventing the risk of spread of diseases. So, you know, educating on not sharing needles, using condoms, getting tested and knowing your HIV status. And also, you know, there's been a big focus on hepatitis A as well, so outbreaks related to that IV drug use. And so I know that McLean County Health Department has already done some work on getting hepatitis A vaccines into at-risk populations. So, you know, a lot of it is about bringing the services to people where they are, meeting them where they are, instead of trying to always expect them to come and receive the services.
One of the major health issues on the forefront of our minds in Illinois is marijuana. Now that its recreational use is legal, Missouri, where you are now, just approved medical cannabis, I understand. Now, no one is pretending that people weren't already using marijuana here, but this does introduce cannabis to a population that may not have experience with it and may not know what a safe amount might be for them. How should the medical community here prepare for this?
Well, obviously, I've been doing a lot of reading up on legislation and trying to, you know, prepare myself for what, you know, this will be a change, obviously. And, you know, in public health, again, we focus on education. So similarly to other substance use, from a safety standpoint, so impairment, judgment, dangers of driving after smoking or ingesting marijuana, and so really knowing the risks, so working with parents, teachers, and youth to know, you know, how marijuana would affect brains of adolescents that are still developing, and, you know, how that would, the long-term effects, we don't know, you know, significant information about long-term effects yet, but we know, you know, smoking any product, including marijuana, can damage your lungs and cardiovascular system.
And more young people, we understand, are using vaping devices to get the THC from cannabis into their systems. You feel like through public education, you are going to try to deter this, to reduce the use, particularly among young people?
Obviously, you know, again, coming into a new environment, I've got a lot to learn about the staff there, the community, the programs and initiatives that are already in place. So, you know, reducing initiation in schools amongst youth is a focus on vaping-related issues. So, you know, I'm assuming that, again, treating marijuana similarly in a public health focus of, you know, knowing the risks and, again, as a safety standpoint from knowing impairment and judgment and the dangers of that.
And advocates say that legal marijuana, now that it is legal and is being taxed, will be safer than getting it off the streets. Assuming users start going to legal suppliers, how much of a difference might that make in the overall health of what they're ingesting?
I can't really answer to that at this point.
As we continue here on Sound Ideas with the incoming McLean County Health Department Director, Jessica McKnight, McLean County is expected to soon adopt zoning guidelines for cannabis dispensaries that might want to set up in unincorporated parts of the county. While the county could get up to 2 dispensaries to start, the county board recently voted narrowly against opting out of allowing a cannabis business in their jurisdiction. Do you plan to advise the county board or the administration about cannabis in the future?
Obviously, it's something that, you know, we're starting to discuss, and, you know, I haven't taken over the position yet at this moment. So, but we have had conversations with the new board chair, Carla Pohl, just about those zoning guidelines and the dispensaries. So it's something that's going to continue to be on our radar and up for discussion.
Is it something that you would advise them to mitigate, to stay away from, or to accept on some level?
Again, at this point, I can't really speak to what my advisement would be for or against.
If we can shift to budgeting, the county has put considerable emphasis on behavioral health in recent years, using money from a sales tax to Bloomington Normal. It's being administered largely through county administration, which has a director running these programs through the Behavioral Health Coordinating Council. What role would you like to see the county health department play in improving mental health?
So mental health, you know, it's a top priority out of the recent community health needs assessment and, you know, has seen increased budgetary support. So really focusing on reducing stigma, reducing those risky behaviors, suicide, and the role of the health department, like you've mentioned, is to provide funding to support service providers' delivery of those evidence-based programs and stay involved in those key partnerships. So again, like you've mentioned, the Mental Health Advisory Board and the McLean County Board for Care and Treatment of Persons with a Developmental Disability, you know, just as an administrator, being involved and aware of what those programs are and how the health department can also support those. So one project, you know, being the embedded school programs, providing emergency counseling, crisis management to children without those individual education plans. And it's something that is expanding. So again, talking with the board about what has been going on and what their plans are, what they hope to see happen.
Now, while the county has expanded its efforts in behavioral health, the department budget for the health department has been cut. It saw a 7% reduction last year, more than $600,000. and they basically tried to keep the tax rate the same. Do you feel that that is manageable heading into 2020?
Mm-hmm. Yes, yeah. Public health is a constantly changing field. So, you know, you're seeing emerging and re-emerging diseases, and, you know, focuses are changing. And public health is community-focused, so the community is your patient, you're assessing priority issues, identifying interventions. And so as needs change, funding opportunities change, and budgets change. So, you know, seeing budgets change and then, a focus going on those priorities like mental health.
Well, the budget shows a reduction in three employees, technically 3.3 full-time equivalents. Do you have a sense for what areas that where services might be impacted?
Mm-hmm. My understanding is from the health education realm is the aspect is what has been decreased.
Now, you step into a position that has been filled on an interim basis by Tammy Brooks, as you had mentioned, as she filled that post for about 6 months. So including the interims, you are now the fifth top administrator in the health department in the last 3 years. Any concerns about continuity, staff morale with all of those changes? Anything that you would look to address along that front?
So, you know, again, Camille laid some groundwork in what she was doing internally and, you know, within the community that I feel very positive about. And Tammy has done a fantastic job over the last couple months of really just keeping moving things forward. So, you know, that's my goal, is to get in there and find out, you know, how can we keep moving things forward positively. And so, you know, does not intimidate me at all. I don't feel any reservations about what I'm stepping into. I feel very positive about moving things forward.
Going back to the funding issue, the Board of Health in McLean County collects its own taxes and has its own funding separate from the county board. What role, if any, do you feel the county board and its elected leaders have in overseeing how the health department handles its budget and how county administration communicates with the health department administration?
Yeah, so obviously there's a lot to learn about that partnership, but obviously it is a very important partnership to communicate the board and the county board back and forth of, you know, you're tasked as the health department with protecting the community in sense of health, and so the county has a, you know, very interested stake, I guess, in that and how that works. So it's a partnership that I look forward to getting to know better.
That is incoming McLean County Health Department Director Jessica McKnight with WGLT's Eric Stock. McKnight starts January 27th. Her salary will be $92,000.
The secret to love? It's in this equation.
W at T plus one equals little w plus IHM brackets HT.
That's so romantic.
Oh, yeah. I struggle to find anything you can't get an interesting perspective on by using math.
I'm Guy Raz. How numbers rule the world. Next time on the TED Radio Hour from NPR. Listen to the TED Radio Hour Sunday at 10 a.m. WGLT and WGLT.org.
Support for WGLT comes from Vision Point Eye Center, offering Central Illinois an eye care destination with personal attention from caring doctors, life-changing innovation, and the exclusive 1107 Optique Eyewear Boutique. Vision Point Eye Care, clearly you. Details at visionpointeye.com. This is 89.1 WGLT and WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Still to come, Congresswoman Sherry Bustos talks with Tim Shelley. This week, we've been taking a look at Illinois' practice of sending hundreds of special needs students to residential facilities in other states. Today, Dusty Rhodes asks if anyone has a solution in the last segment of our series, Far From Home.
In the 2017-18 school year, Illinois taxpayers funded the placement of close to 350 special education students at some 40 facilities in other states. Those facilities are as varied as the students' needs. Some, like HeartSpring in Kansas, are certified to handle a range of disabilities, from autism to traumatic brain injury. About 30 Illinois students live at Hart Spring, and it enjoys a great reputation. Some facilities focus on only one or two special needs, typically emotional disability and the classification other health impairment, which includes hyperactivity and ADD. Those labels aren't an exact science, and neither is the treatment. And that means that sending teens to facilities in remote locations involves some risk, not only to the district's budget, but also to the child.
These schools vary in quality and appropriateness and should not be used unless they're truly, truly needed.
Jennifer Smith is an education attorney with 16 years of experience representing school districts.
And it's just a balance between safety and, you know, some of these techniques to keep them safe obviously mean really restricting their freedoms. So I don't have the right answer.
I have to say you stumbled upon one area that still perplexes me in private practice, but definitely perplexed me when I was at the State Board.
That's Stephanie Jones, former general counsel for the Illinois State Board of Education.
There's not a good win-win situation. I mean, you're dealing with kids that have a lot of needs. You're dealing with parents that are in a very difficult position. You're dealing with an industry that isn't necessarily very well regulated and is not often within the four corners of Illinois. You're dealing with schools that have to make decisions about the best way to spend the money. And is it more prudent to fight it and try to stop the placement? Or is it better to find some sort of middle ground and pay for some or all of the placement and avoid all the litigation costs?
The decision should not be made on a whim. There's an abundance of investigative reports documenting physical and sexual abuse in what's known as the troubled teen industry. Those stories sometimes lead to a facility being shut down, but often they reopen under new ownership with the same staff and the same mindset.
See, I equate residential programs like emergency rooms. These are bad places, but if you really need it, thank goodness they exist. You don't want to go to a hospital because you can get like staph infections and things like that. You wouldn't get anywhere else. But if you really need help, what are you going to do?
That's James Kling. He's a behavioral consultant who gives parents and teachers strategies for dealing with difficult children in hopes of keeping them in their regular schools and their families' homes.
So I don't know what the answer is as far as these higher level kids, but I do know that the answer has to include the parents.
Aaron Woolridge worked at three different programs in Utah for so-called troubled teens, including the admissions office at Discovery Academy. Reading over the applications, she realized some were just normal kids with troubled parents.
Some of those kids have been abused, and their families were abusive. And so part of the difficulty of these places is that the families send the kids to be fixed because it's the kids' problem, supposedly, when really kids' problems come from somewhere. Things are always more complicated than it's just this one kid in the family who has a bunch of problems. You know, things come out of a bigger situation.
Kling says he's noticed a shift among programs that treat emotional disabilities. They've gotten better at looping in the parents and having family meetings to lay the groundwork for the students' eventual transition back home.
Sometimes it works fantastic, and sometimes it doesn't. And it's an awful large amount of money for the, I hope it works. Because hope is not a bad thing. You just don't want that to be your primary strategy.
And that's especially true when a child is far from home. I'm Dusty Rhodes.
This is 89.1 and WGLT.org, Bloomington Normal's only locally owned and operated broadcast media outlet. You can hear Far From Home at WGLT.org. We have a new logo, and that means it's time to freshen up your public media merchandise. Learn more at WGLT.org. Shop our online store for new shirts, mugs, bags, and more. You'll find merchandise with our new logo or retro NPR designs. Prices start at just $10. Show off your public media pride. Shop and buy now at our website. That is WGLT.org. This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Still to come, John Norton deals with the legacy of the blues and the innovation of Chicago blues as well. A new book is out, and he has an interview with the author. Congresswoman Sherry Bustos recently sat down with Tim Shelley to talk about the 2019 legislative year and what's coming up in the year ahead.
One of the Moline Democrats' major initiatives was the Lower Drug Prices Now Act. The bill would allow Medicare to negotiate drug prices directly with pharmaceutical companies. It would also allow private insurers to adopt those rates. But despite bipartisan support for lowering drug prices, President Trump and Republicans say they won't support the bill. We asked Bustos if there's a middle ground on the issue.
Well, I think the middle ground is the fact that when President Trump was candidate Trump, he put this out there as one of the top issues that he would address. And he is on record saying that, I believe his words were something along the lines of, we will negotiate the heck out of prescription drug costs. So this is a bill that offers that up in a reasonable way, offers savings that again can be funneled back in and help seniors in a deeper way. I'm of the mindset that you've always got to be willing to compromise in the kind of government we work in. And we have a Democratic-controlled House, Republican-controlled Senate, and a Republican in the White House. And if we don't have that attitude that we can't give a little to get a little, then we're never going to get anything done. So to your point, absolutely there's some give on this. And I just hope in the end we can get something done and it can be put into place and help our seniors and help people with insurance in addressing one of the most costly parts of our healthcare system.
She also talked about her Rural Green Partnership, which she calls a rural-friendly way to address climate change.
And this is literally looking at the climate through a Midwestern lens and through an agricultural lens. And we're saying, number one, we want a seat at the table. Number two, we can be part of the solution. So what does that look like? When you have the kind of land mass that we have in the rural Midwest, and in much of the congressional district I represent is rural, we can do wind energy can play a major part of that. Solar energy can play a major part of that. As you look at family farms, we have cover crops that can be an important part of that. Rural broadband, very, very important for precision agriculture. Carbon capture, we have a component that looks at, if you look at some of our ethanol plants, what can we do with the carbon? We've got a proposal to look at low interest loans to build pipelines for carbon capture where that can be stored underground. So we can be part of that.
People impacted by the changing energy industry, like the workers at the closing coal-fired power plants in Bartonville and Canton, would be part of that initiative.
We've got to make sure that people who are forced out of their professions, when you look at the coal-fired plants, forced out of the profession, what are we going to do? These are some of the best paying jobs that we have in and around where we're sitting right now. And we want to make sure that there is training for the jobs that they want to do, that they, if they want to go back to school. You also have to look at somebody. If you're 55, 60 years old, what are you going to do? We've got to make sure that we're helping families like that. I think a lot of it is going to have to be through training and getting ready for the next profession.
Congresswoman Sherry Bustos represents parts of Peoria and Pekin. I'm Tim Shelley.
Representative Bustos also talked about her thoughts on the recent American confrontation with Iran and what she thinks of the eventual Democratic presidential nominee and what that person needs to understand about districts like hers. You can find that at WCBU.org. This is 89.1 and WGLT.org. I'm Charlie Schlenker, and you're listening to Sound Ideas. Author David Whitus believes blues music and blues artists don't get proper recognition as part of the great African-American migration of the 20th century. This is past summer concert headliner and Chicago blues elder statesman Jimmy Burns. He's one of many artists profiled in Whitus's new book, Blues Legacy, Tradition and Innovation in Chicago. It's just out from the U of I Press. Whitus highlights Chicago blues artists that span from those who helped define the post-war era to today's inheritors of that legacy. He tells WGLT's John Norton he also wanted the book to add to the thin Chicago history of how families and mentors bequeathed their music from one generation to the next.
You know, I pass by your house three or four times a day. You know, I walk by your house.
And I wanted to show that what's going on today is part of a living continuum that goes back generations and that, of course, originated in the South. And it's really part of that same epic story of the Great Migration, the African-American diaspora of the 20th century that virtually created mid-late 20th century American popular culture in so many ways. This is part of that story. And unfortunately, I think even today, the blues isn't always taken seriously as part of that story. You know, we hear about the great men and women, the great people of arts and letters who came to Chicago, moved to Harlem, moved to Detroit, moved to the Midwest, and to California. And somehow, this particular blues genre isn't often included in that discussion. And I do think Muddy Waters and Howlin' Wolf and Coco Taylor and beyond need to be considered seriously as part of that really grand, epic, cultural phenomenon.
Do you mean that they brought the blues with them from the South? Is that what you're getting at?
This is part of African-American Southern culture that spread through the country, along with gospel, along with jazz, along with the intellectual and artistic gifts of the people of that era, of that generation. And I think it deserves to be talked about in the same way. You know, you read a book like The Warmth of Other Suns, and the work of people like Dempsey Travis and other historians, Timmy O. Black, talking about the diaspora and the Great Migration and how it gave so much to American culture and American history. Also, of course, was a matter of struggle and prevailing against oppression. And this is part of that story. This is part of that grand epic story. In a relatively small way, I'm not claiming to have an epic here, but I wanted to discuss this in that context.
Why do you think it hasn't been as well recognized as you think it should be?
Well, there are a lot of reasons. From the very beginning, at least in terms of the white so-called discovery of the music, you know, the old folkies and the old archivists, they meant well. And I'm not at all criticizing people who went south and discovered people like Funhouse or Skip James or whoever else, or who discovered all those old 78s and realized there was a treasure trove of artistic expression here. But I don't think they approached it from the same artistic and cultural standpoint that jazz historians and historians of literature and poetry and other high art, shall we say, that discussed other aspects of this same history. And it was kind of shunted to the side in that sense and became entertainment for dilettantes. And I think people miss the deeper implications. I mean, that's a general statement, and I'm not saying that was always the case, but kind of like so-called Dixieland jazz, it was trivialized as kind of goofy party music for a long time before people realized how serious it was in the lives and culture of the people of New Orleans and Louisiana and the South in those early days. And today, I think, it's trivialized by being made kind of a tourist attraction without that deeper connotation being understood.
Your book is segmented into four basic sections: the bequeathers, the council of elders, the inheritors, and the heirs apparent. And you mentioned how a couple of these people, actually more than a couple, I think, passed away before the book could actually be published.
Right.
In each of those categories, which there's some fluidity, I understand, in there as well in the categories, but how did they take to what you were approaching in this book? Was it something that they've had hoped somebody had been doing a long time ago? Were they really excited that you were approaching it this way?
I don't think I gave anyone a big theoretical exegesis. I just said, hey, man, I'm doing a book and I want you in it, you know, because your story is important. Again, I didn't patronize people. I didn't say you're a symbol or you're a representative or I'm going to use you to prove a rhetorical point. Most of the folks here I knew personally. In some cases, we were good friends. In other cases, we were just acquaintances. But we knew each other, and I was interested. And I wanted to make sure that people realized that this story is important, and your story is important, and I want to tell your story. I want you to tell your story in your own words and celebrate this story for what it is. I was very touched by how open and honest people were about their lives and their stories.
Our guest is David Whitus. He's in Chicago. He's just written a new book called Blues Legacy, Tradition and Innovation in Chicago. I have interviewed a lot of blues people over the years, not nearly as many as you, but some of the names that you had in this book, certainly, whether it's James Cotton, Eddie Clearwater, Jimmy Burns.
Yeah.
And going to what you just said, I always walked away from those interviews going, man, these guys would have talked all day if I would have let them. They really appreciated that someone was interested in their life, what they have done, and maybe what they're continuing to do. I'm guessing you got that same sense from what I'm just hearing from what you said?
Well, we certainly had good conversations. You know, I mean, Cotton gave a lot of interviews, especially toward the end. He was revered as an elder statesman. Eddie Shaw, Jimmy Johnson, Eddie Clearwater, Jimmy Burns are highly respected among blues aficionados. In some ways, even people like Jimmy Johnson and Eddie Clearwater, blues fans love them. But the general listenership or the general audience might not be as familiar with them as really they should be. So a lot of people were very happy to talk to someone who was putting them in this context for a book about American blues. And I think that a lot of people were very conscious of the fact that this, you know, it's really kind of late in the game for this.
Is, as someone who's run a blues station for a long time, you know, I keep hearing that, you know, the blues just keeps coming back. It's very resilient, right? And right now it seems to be in sort of a down, in sort of a lull. But, you know, the resiliency showed itself in the 60s when those British artists brought American blues back to America. It happened in the 80s with the popularity of Stevie Ray Vaughan. What sense did you get from some of these people that another blues revival may be on the way, or what is the state of blues in their mind right now?
Well, as far as the music, everybody said, hey, the music has a message that's not going to die. The music's going to be there in one way or another forever. You know, the examples you gave raise a very contentious issue because everything you just said, it took a bunch of white folks to bring this music, bring this music back. And the artists who were the originators kind of had to follow in their coattails. Albert King loved Stevie Ray Vaughan. It's not Stevie Ray's fault, okay? As Shemeika said, Stevie Ray definitely revered where the music came from and the elders. I mean, Albert King loved Stevie Ray Vaughan. He considered him his godson, in a way. But it was maddening to me to see Albert King opening shows for Stevie Ray Vaughan. Should have been the other way around. Albert King did not have to hold on to Stevie Ray's coattails. And all those British artists who came over. Okay, the Rolling Stones had Howlin' Wolf open their show on Shindig, that famous show they did where they showcased Howlin' Wolf. But why did he need them to do that? And the different artists have different takes on that. Shemeika says, that's fine. People know where the music came from. She's very proud of the music. She's proud of the music's heritage as black music. But she's also very universalist in her approach. She sings for all people, and she says that's the way it has to be. Other people are a little bit more acerbic about it. They do see cultural appropriation going on. Nellie Travis is worried that the blues is even going to retain its identity as black music. So is Sugar Blue, to an extent. But this dynamic is talked about, either hopefully or not, by everyone. Everyone is aware that this has been going on for a long time. Now, as far as the music overall popularity today, it's much more difficult now than it was even a few years ago for a so-called niche music to really thrive because we don't have radio. Yes, we have the internet, but the problem with that is you're not going to search for something if you don't know it's there. An up-and-coming artist in a genre like blues or the contemporary Southern soul blues genre, which is the modern blues in the South, if you never heard of them, you're not going to go look for them. And it's not just happening in blues, it's happening in a lot of genres. It's a lot more difficult than it was. Clubs are closing, people aren't going out as much, the road is a lot more expensive, travel, gas, accommodations, and so on. At least arguably, the blues attract a somewhat older audience, which means they're probably not going to be heavy drinkers. So some clubs don't book the blues because they don't make as much money. So that doesn't mean there's no hope for it, but it means it's more of a challenge.
David Whitus, author of Blues Legacy, here on WGLT's Sound Ideas. You brought up the Chicago Blues Clubs and how they play traditional, and it's a tourist attraction. It's a big right. tourist attraction with the city of Chicago. Chicago Tribune arts critic Howard Reich a few years ago wrote a somewhat critical column exactly about that, how these clubs are catering to these tourists coming in from other countries and other parts of our country for a, they want a traditional sound, and that in his mind, he thought it's kind of stifling the growth of blues itself, the evolution of the music itself. Did you get a sense from talking to these people that there was a similar idea, or on the other hand, did it give them a place to play?
Well, I think most musicians would concur with this, that most listeners, even those tourists, even the dreaded white blues tourists, have bigger ears, more appreciation for different stylistic variations than the club owners give them credit for. It's not the audiences who say, I don't want to hear that, that's not real blues. It's the club owner who tells someone who may be kind of funky, or maybe a little bit more rocked out, or may not be lump-de-lump-de-lump 12-bar blues, no, we can't hire you, you're not real blues. I just spoke with Joe Pratt, who's the bass player for Source One Band. I mentioned them in the book. And they play a modern R&B soul blues kind of melange of styles. And they got a gig at Buddy Guy's Club opening for someone else on a Wednesday night, a real tough gig. The crowd loved them so much that they got a headlining slot. Right? This is Buddy Guy's Club, blues tourist capital of the world. Joe said, man, we were like new candy to those people. They never heard something like us. They loved us. And I've seen Melody Angel at Buddy Guy's. I've seen Miss Reese, who's also in the book, who's a contemporary soul blues stylist at Buddy Guy's. I've seen Sarnetta Davis from Detroit, a wonderful vocalist, very eclectic style at Buddy Guy's. They love it. It's not the listeners. It's the club owners who have this idea that the tourists only want lump-de-lump-de-lump all night. And I don't think that's true.
Interesting. What did you take away from the book that maybe surprised you from the time you started?
Well, I learned more about the people. I knew Little Ed pretty well. We'd kind of been casual acquaintances for years. But here's this good time party guy. He gets up there on stage and, man, it's a party all night long. And this is a man of very deep emotional depth and sensitivity. He's a deep thinking man, a deep feeling man. And that came through. The way he told me his story, that came through in the story. And I didn't know that side of him. I felt privileged to know that side. And I hope if we did it right, I felt privileged to share that side with people. Same thing with Nelly and other people who told me how and why they became who they are. And I think you're going to go and see them in performance now and say, oh, that's why they're singing this song. That's why they sound this way, or that's where this comes from. And that's part of my intention. And I was very fortunate that people were open and honest enough with me to show that to me.
Oh, that's so cool. I've talked with Ed a couple of times, and I know exactly what you're saying. It kind of caught me off guard the first time, and it's like, this guy's really deep, yeah.
Yeah, right, yeah.
And a really super, super guy.
Well, I'm going to end this. I told you, Denise LaSalle's book is coming out this next year, and she wrote a poem. Actually, the poem is in my previous book, Southern Soul Blues, but the poem is called America's Prodigal Son. It was about the blues. Like the prodigal son was mocked and scorned in his own home, had to go elsewhere, had to go to Europe to be appreciated. Then it comes home, and it still gets short shrifted again. And it was the story of the blues. And she ended it with a very beautiful passage here. And, because she says, people ask me, she said, they can't understand why I keep running back to America. The country that doesn't respect me as one of its pioneers and has little or no regard for me as part of its culture and heritage. She says, they may not understand, but America is my home. I'll always love her. And she goes on and says, they may have forgotten that I am the one that helped them through their hard times, shared their failures and their triumphs. I'll always be grateful to America for making me the great music that I am and for accepting my children, jazz, pop, rock and roll, and my grandchild, rap. Only in America could I have been born, nurtured, and flourished as I have. But until America wakes up and accepts me again and gives me the respect that I rightfully deserve, I'll be a nomad, a prodigal son, immortal and indestructible. But whenever you want me, America, I'm just a musical note away.
Author, journalist, and educator David Whitus speaking with WGLT's John Norton. His new book, Blues Legacy, Tradition, and Innovation in Chicago, is just out from the University of Illinois Press. You can hear the music of Denise LaSalle, Little Ed, and the Blues Imperials, as well as other blues, folk, pop, rock, gospel, soul, Americana, and then some on WGLT's Highway 309. Listen 24/7 at WGLT.org or on 89.1 FM weekends, including tonight, beginning at 9. Thanks for choosing Sound Ideas on WGLT Normal, made possible with listener contributions at WGLT.org. Our website is also where you can find Sound Ideas interviews and stories, which today came from Eric Stock, Ryan Denham, and John Norton. I'm Charlie Schlenker. This is 89.1 WGLT and WGLT.org, Bloomington Normal's public media.